Welcome to Groundwork. My name is Jean Allard, and I'm founder and executive director of the Samaritan Women, a long-term restorative care facility for victims of domestic human trafficking. In this episode, I'd like to engage you in a dialogue about the conditions of safety and security within your shelter program. I'm going to use as a backdrop for these remarks Biederman's chart of coercion. If you're not familiar with that instrument, you really should be. This comes from 1973, and Biederman's work was to look at the tactics that are used against prisoners of war to coerce them, to force them into compliance. It was later adapted by the field of domestic violence, where they looked at the tactics used against prisoners of war and compared them to similar tactics that a domestic violence offender uses on his or her victim. We have recently adapted that chart to look at those same methods of coercion and how they play out within the industry of human trafficking. We have submitted a PDF document associated with this episode that includes our comparative of human trafficking tactics for each of the methods in Biederman's chart. So at a very high level, let me just go through some of those methods. Biederman talks about using the tactic of isolation to deprive the victim of social support, making them feel that they are, in fact, separate from anybody who can help them. Monopolization of perception, basically fixing their attention on their immediate situation, eliminating any competing stimulation, frustrating any actions that they have that would give them some sense of autonomy, induced debility and exhaustion, basically weakening their mental or physical ability to resist, outright threats, cultivating anxiety or despair, the use of occasional indulgences, providing positive motivation. Basically, it's that yin and yang of I'm going to punish you, but then I'm going to reward you, but then I'm going to punish you, but then I'm going to reward you, that really creates a disorientation for the victim. Demonstrating omnipotence, basically taking all agency away from the victim and transferring it on to the captor or to the oppressor, suggesting that there's any futility in the victim resisting that oppressor. Degradation, basically demeaning the individual in terms of their self-esteem, in terms of reducing them down to an almost animalistic level of response. There's much to be discussed here. And then enforcing trivial demands, developing a habit of compliance from the victim because the captor keeps the individual so disoriented and has these capricious and somewhat irrational expectations or demands so that the victim really doesn't understand why they have to do what they have to do. They just become so brainwashed to know that they must do whatever is being demanded of them. So you can already, if you've been doing this work, begin to see where these methods of coercion already play out within the oppression of a human trafficking victim. So we've offered our chart there. You might have some additional suggestions that you could offer that would help to strengthen this chart. And if you do, I would invite you to send your suggestions to me via email. My email address is jallert@thesamaritanwomen.org. So let's move on to talking about safety and security as we use Biederman's chart as a backdrop. I think, in fact, I firmly contend that Hollywood does us a great disservice because in any rendering of human trafficking cases or stories, there seems to be an overemphasis on physical security, that there is this idea that all of the threats against these individuals are external threats that they have to do with their physical safety. those of us who are doing this work know that it's much more complex than that. That's not to diminish the significance of physical safety, but it is not the only aspect of safety to which we need to attend. So I'd like us to also look at the fact that in many ways we use safety and security interchangeably as if they are synonymous, and when in fact they aren't. And it's going to be helpful in this podcast for us to have a working distinction between the two. When I'm talking about safety, we are talking about the condition of being protected from or having danger, risk, or injury significantly reduced or rendered unlikely. Now, we all know that safety is not an absolute guarantee. You can be in your own home and be unsafe. You can be attacked in your own home. You can have a seatbelt on and make a measure to be safe, but still get in a car accident. So safety measures are merely there to mitigate as much as possible any potential danger, risk, or injury. But it cannot be guaranteed, only attempted. So we have to be realistic when we talk about what safety measures we have put in place, that these are not 100% fail-safe. When we talk about safety, we tend to relegate that to the domain of external or environmental safety measures. Those are very practical and sometimes tangible things like fences, doors, locks, security systems, cameras, having perhaps an undisclosed location, having security guards or personnel on site, having restrictions on the resident's mobility or access to particular technology. So all of these physical, environmental, or outside the person, external measures, are part of what we deem to be safety measures. And we'll talk a bit about how those play out in terms of mitigating some of these methods of coercion. But the larger portion of our discussion is going to be about security. Security is largely a perception. Security is not a reality. One can feel secure and be in a threatening situation. Those of us who are Christians can say, I am secure in my faith, even though I'm facing adversity. I am secure in God's love, even though I know that person means me harm. That is a perception. It is the perception of feeling safe, stable, and free from anxiety or attack. It often comes with a parallel perception of a sense of constancy or predictability, meaning I am secure because I know where I am now is not where I will always be, or I know I will get through this, or I know I have the means to solve my problem, even though right now it's difficult. So that is largely perception. And I submit to you that the larger portion of work that you need to do to create an environment and to create a perception of safety and security in your facility is to work on those measures that increase the individual's perception that he or she is in fact both physically safe and emotionally, spiritually, relationally secure. So let's move on to looking at the chart, and I'm going to refer just to the column on human trafficking and the different methods, and then talk each about how you can use mitigating strategies to increase the perception of environmental safety and mitigating strategies to increase the perception of personal security. As we look at the method of isolation, or any of the methods, what we're trying to do in the restorative work in emergency shelters, transitional stabilization shelters, or long-term restorative care is we are trying to invert the method that was used against the individual to put them in that state of compliance and threat. So we're trying to turn the table, if you will, by inverting the condition that was used against them. Now, for ease of use, since I have a single gender facility, I'm just going to use the pronoun she to refer to the victim. If you serve males, you'll want to make that apply to you. So for isolation, there are definitely things that you can do in the environment to increase their sense of safety. What you do as far as providing and making sure there are restrictions on access to the phone, to the internet, and to the actual location. What you do in terms of creating a physical space, again, whether it's walls, whether it's fences, whether you have gates. Now, is that isolating the individual or is that creating a sense of safety? Part of that is going to be how you explain it and how they interact with their environment that is going to give them the sense. If there is a clear understanding that those physical measures have been put in place to keep people out, as opposed to keep her in, that's a very different perception. If you have visitors, if you use volunteers, if you allow your residents to have visitors, do you have very clear and openly communicated protocols for how those outside visitors are going to be treated, what access they have to the physical environment? So, for example, in some situations, we do have visitors. We have volunteers who come to our property as tutors, as mentors, as workshop facilitators. But our residents know that in no case is a visitor allowed to go up to the second floor that is residential. So if a resident feels threatened by a visitor, she knows that she can go upstairs and she has control over her environment. She has control over where she goes so that she can have a sense of environmental safety. Certainly making sure that your staff is visible and accessible at all times. We make sure that our staff are regularly doing rounds or walk arounds and just popping their head in and letting ladies know, hey, I just want you to know I'm here. If you need me, I'll be in the kitchen or I'll be in the library or I'll be back in 15 minutes to check on you. And sometimes just that verbal check-in, that visual check-in decreases that sense of isolation, because sometimes the survivor will self-isolate. We also make sure that we plan outings with certain managed freedoms. And what I mean by that is if we're going to go to a store or we're going to go to the park, they should know what boundaries they have for their own freedom. You can go off shopping by yourself, but we all need to be back, you know, at the register by 3 o'clock. Or you can go at the theme park as far as this, but you need to have a buddy with you. So that makes them feel like they are out within the community and not so isolated, and not only isolated in their perception of self, but also within the confines of your physical facility. Mitigating strategies to increase the perception of personal security has to do with educating the resident about her options in dealing with any perceived threat. You might call this coping skills, but this is also coaching her throughout the day. What would you do in this situation? If you didn't feel safe, what would you do? What could you do? So, for example, when we do an orientation with a new resident, we make sure that she knows, here's the staff room. You may knock on this door at any hour, night or day. You may come in at any time when you need something. If you are feeling uncomfortable in your room or you're feeling alone or isolated, here's where people hang out. Here's where you can come get some fellowship. Group therapies go a long way to mitigating the sense of isolation, not only in the isolation of her experience, but also in how she's coping with those experiences. We follow very much the work of Dr. Judith Herman in trauma and recovery, and the power of group therapies in overcoming this method of isolation that has often been used on them. And certainly the way you engage chaperones, companions, or mentors takes her out of her small world and opens her up to additional relationships so that she feels like she has some social recourse with other persons. Moving on to the monopolization of perception, there's not as much in the physical environment that you can mitigate here because it, by its nature, is talking about perception. So when we talk about restrictions on the phone, internet, or social media, take a look at what's noted here under human trafficking. In monopolization of perception, here the victim is being blamed for her own abuse. Maybe it's being reinforced by others. She feels as though she's caused it. It's her fault, that it's her behavior. And so that monopolizing in how she sees things, or sometimes for the oppressor to constantly be calling or text or emailing to just be berating her with that perception. That's one of the primary reasons why we have such strident restrictions on phone use, no internet use until it's for school, and no access to social media. But you'll want to come up with your own restrictions. We also require that she provide a safe contact list, and then we vet those contacts. Because let's look over in terms of her sense of personal security. What we'll do is for the first 90 days to 120 days, we will actually supervise those phone calls, meaning there's somebody else in the room while those phone calls are taking place. Because even though she may say that her brother or her mother is a safe person to contact, you will very quickly perceive whether or not that person is emotionally safe. If the resident gets on the phone with her mother and her mother starts yelling and cussing her out and blaming her for everything, that's not a safe contact. And so that is another form of oppression that is not safe for her right now until she's built up some skills to be able to meet that kind of dynamic more stably. We also focus our narrative and our conversation on what survival skills has she acquired during her trafficking experience and before, really focusing on her asset-based skills. In terms of induced debility and exhaustion, here you can make a number of physical and environmental accommodations. Consistency of meal times. I can't say enough about this. It is so disorienting and it really works against you to be too casual about meals, because many of our girls in particular have been controlled by starvation. And so we will see eating disorders, we will see hoarding, we will see a lot of jealousy and anxiety around food. And so the consistency of the mealtime is very important. Also making available certain discretionary foods, things like fruits or granola bars, to say outside of mealtime, you can always have access to these things. That might be coffee or tea or juices. We make it a high priority for accommodations in her sleep environment. So within the first week, we want to make sure that she has an environment for sleep that is conducive to her needs. If that provides a nightlight, maybe a set of headphones so that she can have some light music, maybe adjusting the bedding or the positioning of where her bed is. Just things like if her bed is positioned by a window and that makes her incredibly anxious, can she move it? In our schedule, we've also incorporated blocks of time during the day where somebody can take a nap or have quiet time, and they can govern how they use the discretionary time so that she begins to feel as though she's not so going to be so deprived of sleep and of eat, really those basic needs. Moving over to personal security in that same domain area, giving her freedom about the choices that she has over what she can wear. Now, we have guidelines about what's appropriate dress, but even within that, she needs to know that she can make some choices. One of the things that's a choice thing that seems small, but it is significant, particularly for women, is we allow her to change her hair color, frankly, as many times as she wants to. Sometimes just something like that lets her know that she has control over her own world and her own physical presence. We invite our residents to participate in the meal planning so that it is not controlled for them. But if she doesn't want to eat meat, or if she has a particular favorite menu item or a comfort food. And then wellness activities that allow her to balance sleep with awake time. If you're in an emergency or even a stabilization shelter, you will find that they are very inconsistent in terms of their sleep and awake patterns, perhaps being very nocturnal, or if they've been using substances like cocaine to stay awake for 3 days straight so that they can work more. One of your primary priorities is to focus on a regular schedule of eating and sleeping. Looking at the threats that are available that she perceives, and then real threats, Hopefully, most of what you've done in your environment is to mitigate anybody from presenting a real threat to her, coming to kidnap her, children, abandonment, arrest, destruction of her property, those kinds of things. You might allow residents to lock things up. Maybe they have a locker and then a key that they have control over. And so if they're worried about any destruction of personal property, what we do is we say if there's anything that's precious to you and you want it to be under lock and key, you give that to us and we have a locked area that we control, but she can come over at any time and know that her goods are safe with us. We've also issued flashlights. You can get just those small personal handheld flashlights, and she can be allowed to have that on her person at any time. And that's just maybe $1 to $2 per person to make a simple accommodation that can go a long way to giving her some control over her environment. Even if it's just to have to get up in the middle of the night to use the restroom, she has some control over that. Where you can do a lot in terms of mitigating threat is where you increase personal security around verbal reassurances of her safety, changing the language that you use instead of threatening her for the consequences of her decision. Instead of saying threats as in, if you don't do this, this will happen, you can use different language by saying, what would be the consequence? What do you think is an appropriate consequence? What do you expect to be a consequence for making a particular type of decision? And really educating the survivor about consequences for actions and decisions. We think it's very important to train your staff not to make any particular promises to the survivors, even promises like, I'll see you tomorrow. Because what's going to happen if something unexpected delays that staff person from coming in tomorrow? That survivor is going to immediately feel a threat of abandonment. And so don't even make the promise. They might be able to see the schedule and see who's coming in and who's going to be on coverage and begin to know that. I will tell you, it tends to be a big deal in our facility that our residents always want to know who's on coverage when and get quite discombobulated when the schedule changes because of some spontaneous situation. Another thing that we have taken some initiative to work on is a threat that some survivors have is a threat of police, a fear of the police, maybe for good reason, maybe threat of being arrested without just cause or poor treatment. And so we have actually created some friendly relationships with local law enforcement, and we engage with them. We do activities with them. Sometimes police will just come over and be a part of a barbecue, or they might be leading a workshop, or we might do a co-facilitation of some program and allow our ladies to be able to see law enforcement professionals in a different light, to get to know them personally, to better understand their jobs and the conditions under which they work. Maybe even allowing the law enforcement person to listen to your survivors about their experiences so that there can be some mutual sharing. It's really gone a long way to reduce that perception of threat. So now when a law enforcement professional does come to our facility, they are greeted amicably as opposed with everybody running off into separate corners. So let's look at things like occasional indulgences. That really shouldn't apply in your environment at all. There shouldn't be a situation where you give favor to somebody, that you reward behavior with gifts. That's just a pretty negative practice. You might come up with rewards that are something related to what she wants to have control over. So for example, maybe it's a $5 or $10 gift card that she can earn by doing a particular chore or job, but then she has control over how she spends that. But certainly the lavishing of gifts or any kinds of expensive items. What we're really looking at here is where does a survivor believe she has to manipulate her environment or her behavior to get favored status? And that just shouldn't be a part of your culture at all. Be very careful about deploying any kind of hierarchy. What we do is we make sure that favored status or progress, a better way of putting it, is so clearly delineated, meaning you advance in the program when you achieve certain milestones, when you have made particular progress, when there is fruits, frankly, of your work. And so we put on the wall what those fruits are. Actually, in our kitchen, the fruits of the spirit is painted right on the wall, and they have every day can take a look and see how they're growing in terms of those areas. So it's not an indulgence, it's an earned condition. There also shouldn't be any demonstration of omnipotence in your environment. You will have hierarchy by virtue of the fact that you have a director and you have supervisors, and it is very important that your survivors learn about healthy structures and authority. But any kind of omnipotent or sense of irrational authority you need to guard against. You also need to have a zero tolerance policy for any kind of physical contact or posturing or threat of physical contact. You know, bumping or getting in somebody's space or puffing up or doing particular gestures that are known to be threatening or intended to be threatening need to be nipped in the bud immediately. There also shouldn't be any reason why you have to have an environmental mitigation against degradation. You shouldn't have an environment in any way that condones name-calling or any interpersonal condemnation. But let me go a little further on degradation, look a little deeper into that, and also say that we advocate that a survivor should have complete control over her story. So when we're talking about what is demeaning or degrading, sometimes forcing or eliciting their story in a way that they feel compelled to tell you can be a form of degradation. You know, we had a situation not too long ago where a news crew wanted to interview some of the survivors, and we're so very, very careful about that. And we asked in advance what the questions would be. And one of the questions was, what was the worst thing you ever had to do? What was the worst thing you ever had to get out of? And you could just tell that that line of questioning was going after what was the most degrading or demeaning? How bad did it get? And it was really going after the sensational. And you have to guard against that and let her know that she has control over not responding to those types of promptings. Teaching her non-threatening assertions, like being able to say, I prefer not to answer. I'm not comfortable with that. I'd like to stop this conversation now. To do so in an assertive and confident way, and you back her up on it. And so when you create phrases like that, you just have a culture that says when somebody says, I'd like to stop now, you stop. No questions asked. And then enforcing trivial demands. We have to be careful about this in our environments because sometimes we are learning on the fly, and it seems like, particularly for new shelters, we're having to come up with rules at the spur of the moment because they've presented something we didn't think of. That's going to happen. Just like with parenting, you didn't anticipate that they were going to come up with that behavior, and so now you have to create some rules on the fly. It's somewhat inevitable, but as much as you can, make sure that your rules and the consequences are in writing and that you have gone through all of those. For us, it's in a handbook with your residents. Now, we don't just do that at intake. We use the opportunity of community meetings to go over a page of the rules each meeting so that we are constantly reinforcing these are our rules and these are the consequences. You also have to be mindful that in the coercion of trivial demand, oftentimes just changing those rules in a capricious way, almost playing mind games with the individual, is really what is the most disrupting. And so what we will do is wherever possible, we will have posted recognition of what are the chores, what are the schedules, what are the expectations, what's the programming. So our house has a lot of whiteboards and has a lot of charts around, but it helps people to be able to constantly remind themselves, okay, these are the chores and how equitably they are distributed across the population. Everybody knows the interval with which they are rescheduled. They understand that based on where you are in the program, what different chores might be assigned with you and how they're negotiated, how the scheduling of the day is going to go. And we try to give them as much autonomy and dominion over their schedule as they can possibly handle. So here, giving them some authority, giving them some latitude in saying, you can do this or you can do that, but here are the consequences, which do you choose? And allowing them to make those decisions. You might have a structure where you have a senior resident who begins to take some of the ownership of allocating the chores or the schedules or the expectations. And that's another way of sort of taking it off of formal authority and making it a part of your community and part of your culture. So while this has been a rather plodding walk through this chart of coercion, I just want to wrap by saying that we have to put into balance what we are doing in the physical environment with perhaps and sometimes the more heavily weighted perception of security. We have to better understand what has happened to that victim, what method of coercion was used on them, and how can you in your environment and in your culture invert that method so that he or she gains much more control over their own autonomy, authority, and their own sense of perception of safety and security in your physical and your interpersonal environment. If you haven't downloaded these PDF documents, I would encourage you to do so, and I will reiterate the offer that if you have suggestions that are good to share with the community, I'd be happy to hear your suggestions and what's worked for you so that we can all benefit from each other's experience. I hope this has been helpful to you, and I hope that you will continue to join us for future episodes of Groundwork. Thank you, and God bless.